Chapter 12. The Blizzard and the Birthing Chamber. The blizzard that swept in 2 days after my duel was brutal. It started coming down innocuously enough, a friendly sprinkle of snow just at dusk. But by moonrise, if the moon hadn't been obscured by clouds, it was snowing so hard you could hear it hit the ground. These were big, thick, fat, juicy snowflakes. The kind that take an age to leisurely fall and seem to pile up faster than creditors. If this was what Astaroth thought of as less fierce than he got, I shuddered to think of just how deep Tudri was buried. Around midnight, the winds kicked in, as the storm began in earnest. Howling winds from the west blew the bountiful snow into drifts that rose as high as the second floor of the castle. It snowed for 2 days straight, and then rained ice and freezing rain, just to keep things interesting. And then more snow. The entire time the winds never stopped blowing, and they were raging hard enough to knock a man off his feet. Except for the storms off the coast of Faerys, I have never seen winds like that before. Neither had any of the native Sevendori, and damn few of the Bavali. It was a calamitous storm in everyone's experience, and if it hadn't been for the magic keeping the place moderately insulated, I'm not sure we wouldn't have woken up frozen to death. Everyone stayed put unless absolutely necessary, and after the first day, it was difficult just opening a door, so high had the drifts piled against them. The great hall of the castle was packed with peasants, as was every cot and hold with a fireplace. The sick and infirm were moved to the warmest places. Thanks to our early notice, we were able to make sure virtually everyone in the valley had plenty of firewood and food to get them through a few days. We had people bedding down in storage spaces, in the towers, in the stables, and in the kitchens. Even Sir Kay opened up his room for 3 scrawny dotards who needed to stay warm. He moved himself in with the guards in one of the towers, when he slept. My private residence was kept private only because I demanded it. Alia would have allowed it to be used if needed, but I needed at least one space I could get away from everyone who was suddenly crammed into my home. And I didn't want anyone crowding my wife when she was so close to term. As it was, her matrons were constantly there, giving us little privacy and almost no peace. Everyone else had to contend with crowded conditions, but apart from a line at the privies that ran day and night, it wasn't too bad, for a while. Indeed, with most of the Yule decorations still in place, at first it felt like an extension of the holiday. People diced, sang, played games, had arguments, told tales, prayed, and slept. It was almost like a miniature siege, which was good, in a way. I was able to note some issues that could be addressed once we thawed out, like cisterns that didn't freeze over. I could cure that by heating the stones of the things to just above freezing, and the need for a much bigger hall. I hadn't figured out a spell that could give me that yet, but it was desperately needed for the size population we had now. If we were really under attack, and I had to put everyone in the Vales in here, I would have peasants encamped all the way to the Outer Bailey, and I doubtlessly would have lost many of them to the storm. This way we were on each other's nerves, cranky and cold, but we were fed and we were warm enough to live. I made a point of making the rounds to check on everyone in the castle at least a few times a day, and spent most of that time settling arguments or delivering stern warnings about poor behaviour. I also kept in regular contact with my apprentices, who were learning what it was like to be in charge of a bunch of panicky folks in an emergency. I had Tyndall at Brestall Tower, with our prisoners, most of the garrison, and the peasants of Brestall Village. Things were tense, but he managed to rule there without bloodshed. Rondal had drawn the shorter straw, and therefore was taking an extended turn at the gate tower. He didn't mind. There were only 12 Bovali at the Brestall farm site, plus a few nearby cotholders to fill the space. Compared to the cramped quarters at Sevendor Castle and Brestall Tower, Hyre's Tower, known to most now as the Gate Tower or Dyke Tower, was relatively roomy. I checked on both of them, mind to mind, several times a day, and we all seemed to be weathering the storm well enough. The biggest headache was keeping order, keeping them warm and getting them fed. Apart from that, I mostly stayed in my tower lab, planning, plotting, and going over accounts. The forced lethargy of the storm also gave me time to catch up on news, apart from the blizzard that had ravaged the northern duchies from the Penumbra to western Merwin. Penny, safe in her family's sunny estate in central Ramir for the winter, was nonetheless a fount of information on the politics of the moment. "The big news is the Coronet Council," she told me, mind to mind, the first night of the blizzard. "I don't know if you remember, but Duke Lengwin called an emergency council to address the Gavanni invasion. Only he died before it could happen. Duke Rad, in his role as regent for the young Duke, has gotten that postponed until the late spring. It was set for Ramir, but I just heard that it has been moved to the capital. It will be held just after the solstice. And it's going to be colourful." "How so?" I was only half aware of ducal politics, even when I was hip-deep in it. "Besides the whole issue of the Alshari succession." "There won't be an issue," Penny promised. "Lengwin's son will be confirmed as the Duke of Alshar, but only after Rad declares himself king. When that happens, he'll invite the dukes to pay him homage and fealty, and only then will he be confirmed as the king's vassal, along with the Duke of Ramir and his own son, Tavard, who will become the Duke of Castile on his father's coronation. But I'd wager that the Dukes of Vor, and especially Merwin, aren't going to take a knee just because Rad says to. In fact, they might go to war." "Not my problem. It might be. Duke Rad wishes to have his new war magi present to testify to the Coronet Council about the dead god and the goblin invasion." "His new war magi?"
"Min, quit getting yourself upset over political crap you can't do anything about," she lectured. "From his perspective, you are his. His problem, too, because the censorate is a mess."
"What? I thought General Hartarian was going to yield," I asked, startled.
"He is," she assured me, "and many of the censors will no doubt agree with him, but they are having their own convocation in Wenshar this summer, and right now the Merwini ducal censor is calling for Hartarian's head for betraying the order. We might own Hartarian as an ally, but that doesn't mean that Hartarian will remain censor general. In fact, it's a safe bet he won't."
"Then why did I give him a witch stone?" I demanded. "The whole point of that was to bribe the censorate to leave us alone."
"You bribed the censor general, not the censorate," she reminded me. "They have their own systems and rules about who rises in office and how, and some of them are quite fanatical. That's why they get them young, just out of school or apprenticeship, and indoctrinate them so heavily. They've sworn a sacred oath. Unfortunately, some of them take that seriously. Luckily enough won't, so that we might gain some really stout allies from their ranks."
"Right. Look how well Landric is doing," I agreed. The former censor war magi had, like Hartarian had eventually done, taken a bribe of a witchstone from me, and then fought valiantly and faithfully in the bloody Battle of Timberwatch. He was rewarded for his efforts by being made a knight mage and mage lord, and he was one of the most steadfast Horkan war magi I knew. If we could get a few more like him out of the censorate, it almost might be worth fighting them.
"They really are quite tough. Well, your apprentices and I faced down a pair of them in Tulri, just before we fled the town, and if we hadn't had witchstones and low cunning on our side, we'd be facing the pillory in Wenshar now. Censors would be great recruits for the war effort, but a lot of them are going to persist in trying to kill us. The only way we're going to stop that is to ensure that Rad takes the throne and hope that 3/5 of a crown is royalty enough to keep the censors at bay."
"I'm not particularly fond of His Grace right now," I replied. "Her Grace, actually, and that power-hungry bitch of a daughter of theirs."
"You don't have to like them," she pointed out. "In fact, it's probably best if you don't like them, which would make things needlessly complicated. But you do have to support them. We all do. We get them on the throne first, and then we can handle the details."
"And you think presenting a bunch of shiny war magi is going to do that?"
"It's going to be a big step in that direction," she affirmed. "In fact, it would be wise for us to be organized before the council. Have a meeting, maybe in the spring, to figure out some organizational details and fix some policies."
"I don't know, Pen," I replied doubtfully. "There isn't much time before the summer solstice."
"What are you talking about? There's plenty of time.
Most of the High Magi are in Northern Alshar already, and the few who aren't could make it back here in a few weeks,
and if they can't, then we can get their opinions mind to mind. But we need to all be reading from the same scroll, so to speak, because this autumn, when Rad is crowned, we will have a golden opportunity to get, well, whatever we want. But until we know what we want, that's not going to do us much good. So we have a conference, a convention, a convocation, a coven, whatever you want to call it. We get together and map out some policies and procedures and maybe talk about the future. Well, I suppose that would work, I admitted. But where to meet? Tudri? No, she said adamantly. That's too close to the penumbra. I don't want the dead god overhearing anything. We don't know if he has human servants as spies in Tudri yet, but you can bet it will only be a matter of time. Good point. What about Varun? Somehow I don't think we'd be too welcome there, she pointed out. A lot of the Alshari are blaming us for Lengwin's death, and for the whole war. Now they're shy one duke, and from what you and Mavone have said, he was the only reason anyone ever came to the damn place anyway, and it's still hip-deep in refugees. Again, a good point. That leaves Wilderhall. That's what I was thinking, she agreed. But from what you've told me about the family, that might be even worse than Tudri in terms of eavesdroppers. Penny, we're running out of Wilderlands, I said patiently.
I know, I know. Let me think.
It took us almost an hour of brainstorming, and in the end, she had to contact a few other magi mind to mind. But we finally settled on a place from an unlikely source, Farandal of Scafford. Sire Farandal was a scion of a coastal family of aristocrats, and had become a war mage of no small repute when he was recommended by Terlaman, the military head of the order, to get a witchstone. He had fought valiantly at Timberwatch, and already had friends in the Castali and Alshari courts, so when the dukes had been handing out honours, he'd gotten awarded an estate, just like I had. Only he had chosen one about 300 miles southwest of Wilderhall, near the Alshari frontier, a fief known as the Domain of Robinwing. It was a small, out-of-the-way land, much like Sevendor. But unlike Sevendor, it had been fully functional, and even profitable, when Sire Farandal had become its mage lord. That was largely thanks to a big temple on his lands, and ambitious villagers who had hoped to use their time without a lord to advance their own agendas. But Robinwing Castle was spacious and roomy. The village had several good inns, and the temple could house our conference without fear of being overheard. Farandal was delighted to be able to play host too, and I couldn't blame him. I had been tempted to host the meeting myself in Sevendor, just to use the spectre of the best war magi in the world on my bellicose neighbour's border, but in truth, we didn't have the facilities for that kind of meeting. Yet. We set the time for convening the order as 3 weeks after the equinox, which should be long enough after the snows to melt for the roads to be safe, but still too early in the season to take the war magi on the front lines from their posts. We were fairly certain we wouldn't see any major Govani offensives until at least a full moon and a half after the equinox. Govani don't like mud any more than we do, and they hate snow and cold weather. The Robinwing convocation should be relatively well attended. So the censorate still wants us dead, and Rad wants us to show up and scare his enemies, and the family isn't nearly as friendly to us as before. Please tell me you have some good news.
I do,
she agreed. The Order of the Secret Tower is at your beck and call. Daddy's Witchstone has already revolutionized the business here. He's become the most powerful mage on the Order's Council, but they're already lining up and wanting to know what they have to do to get one.
Well, if they're war magi, then I'll grant them a stone if they go to the penumbra for a year, I offered.
They aren't. They're wealthy old practicing adepts and court magi.
Practicing adept or practical adept or even resident adept in Vor is a term that Eastern magi use when they sell their services and are associated with a magical firm. If you're wondering what the difference between a practicing adept and a spellmonger is, so did I. The time I went to visit Penny's family estate in Ramir. After days of argument, I still couldn't see one. But practicing adept apparently sounds more sophisticated and prestigious, and considering how much Penny's dad's firm charged for their spells, I suppose their clients were entitled to the very highest quality bullshit. I don't know, Pen. The war effort has to be our first priority.
I agree.
I just don't think it should be the only priority. Are we going to only allow war magi to have witch stones? Of course not. I've already given stones away to non-war magi. Master Ikarod, the mage healer. Master Thinrattle. Master Dunsellin. Lance of Boon. Your dad. You.
I know. That's my point.
We've dealt with them haphazardly, and in some cases we've lost control of the situation. We need to figure out a good practical method of deciding who gets a stone and who doesn't. That's going to become a political headache before we know it. And that's the sort of thing we need to decide at a conference. How about every fourth stone goes to a non-war mage? I offered.
How about every third stone?
She countered. There are a lot of specialists out there who are eager to expand their abilities. Some specialities that could prove quite useful. Enchanters and healers, for example.
I'd be willing to give one to a decent green mage, I agreed, if he was good enough. Green magic is, as you probably guessed, the magic of plants and growing things. It wasn't a very widely respected specialty, despite how useful it was. Growing stuff just isn't as flashy or impressive as war magic or even common spellmongering. But I'd seen a few talented green magi who could grow roses on a paverstone. I thought about the desolate landscape of Sevendor and wondered what a well-trained, talented green mage could do with the land to make it more productive. In fact, you can put the word out that I will be willing to grant a stone to the green mage who impresses me most.
You're going to be mobbed,
she giggled. I wasn't actually thinking of green magi, but I suppose they could benefit. Just think what a sea mage could do with a stone, or a stone singer, or an adept enchanter, or a really good thaumaturge.
Hey, I am a really good thaumaturge, I protested, and see how much you've been able to accomplish.
We're going to need support, Magi Min, and they're going to need witch stones to do their jobs.
Agreed. What about religious magic?
Theurges? She asked, surprised. If you're worried about the war effort, that's the last place I'd recommend spending our precious stones. How could a temple mage be useful?
This was a common argument for us. Penny never thought religious magic was actually practical, whereas I had seen a few things that convinced me otherwise.
Come on.
Religious magic has accomplished some pretty amazing things, I countered. I admit, it's unreliable and problematic, but it's also quite powerful. There's a reason that even the censorate is careful in how they regulate theurgic magic. You get one of the larger cults angry at you, and even without Irionite, you can tap on the raw emotional power of hundreds or thousands of the devout. That could come in handy.
We can look into it, she said, compromising. It's always nice to have the gods on our side, I suppose.
What about selling the stones outright?
What?
I asked, surprised.
Why would we do that?
To raise money, she said simply. The order is running on a horsehair right now, but it's going to need resources, its own resources.
Selling a stone or two might be a way to do that.
To the proper people, of course, she added.
Like whom? I asked dryly. I knew, Penny. She wouldn't have brought it up if she didn't have someone in mind.
Like my cousin Planus, she offered. You met him when you visited, remember? The really handsome one? He's a very, very good practical adept, and he's also got a good head for business. He's the one who got the family firm into commercial merchandise evaluation and assurance.
What?
He started offering to magically ensure that a shipment of goods arrives intact. He uses a version of the Recitalan grouping spell on a wagon or a barge load of merchandise after it's loaded. When it arrives, the merchant has another mage verify that the entire load has arrived as promised, without any of it falling off the back of the wagon. He charges 5% of the merchandise total.
Does he make good money at it? I asked, incredibly impressed at the idea.
I grew up in a river port. In Tauri, you could always go down to the docks and trade a couple of fresh-baked pies for some of whatever the bargemen were loading, unloading, or hauling to distant ports of call. By the time a shipment made it to its final destination, as much as a quarter of the merchandise might have disappeared. Paying 5% to ensure that it didn't was well worth the price.
It's about a third of the firm's revenues now. And the best part is that the Recitalan grouping is such a simple spell, even second-year apprentices can do an evaluation. Of course, Planus wants a shard of Irionite. He asked me to ask you how much you'd sell one for, outright.
Ishi's nips, Penny. How should I know? They're priceless.
Nothing is truly priceless, she countered, and Planner's side of the family is the really wealthy one. They've had contracts in Central Ramir that stretch back 200, 300 years. So when he asked me to ask you, he also said he would pay you 100,000 ounces of gold for one.
100,000 ounces of gold? I asked, incredulous.
He's got it, or his family does. But he's not worried about the expenditure. With Irionite, he can make that back in 2 years, with what he can do. Probably less. Planets is terribly smart.
He was also handsome and as smooth and charismatic a mage as I'd ever met. The sort that can make you feel like a hayseed hedge mage on your best day.
I don't know, Penny, I said, after I'd recovered. Is that a good precedent?
I don't know, Min, she said tiredly.
Maybe, maybe not.
But why not? It just seems corrupt, somehow. Someone has to decide who gets the stones, Min, and we all decided that it would be you. How you dispose of them is your business, then. But as your advisor and acting steward of the Arcane Orders, may I remind you, let me advise you to think about it strongly. I'd recommend you just give, Planus One, except I know that seems a little too much like nepotism even to me. The money makes that less painful, and with so many other older, more prestigious adepts around,
I'll think about it, I promised. Maybe it is a bad precedent, maybe it isn't. I was thinking that we might want to set up a network of spellmongers and foot wizards to encourage trade in not coral and sympathy stones, weirwood and that sort of thing. There are dozens of substances and items that are invaluable to magic, but they're rare, exotic and scattered. If we're really going to push the art, we're going to need access to them. We should start encouraging that, especially if we're going to take a mercantile approach to Irionite. Maybe we can raise funds by taxing that trade somehow to pay for the order's upkeep.
That's what professional fees are for, Min, she said patiently.
It isn't unusual for someone to pay a fee for a position or a feudal right.
I did just take a sympathy stone from one of my people as a fee for setting up shop in the village, I admitted.
Then you understand that a small fee for a witch stone isn't dishonorable or dishonest? Consider it a feudal arrangement. You, the head of the Arcane Orders, control the witch stones. You dish them out to worthies you know, she said unself-consciously. You take their oaths, just like an oath of fealty. The fee is just another element of that arrangement, and it keeps too many untrained magi from dogging you.
I still don't like the idea of prohibiting someone just because they're poor. Couldn't we make that fee payable within 2 years? That should be plenty of time if the mage is good. That will also help ensure that new members are on their best behavior. If they owe us money, they'll behave better.
That's actually a good idea, Min, she admitted.
I'll add it to the agenda. Oh, and there's another pressing item on the agenda. The Order needs a permanent home, at least some place where we can store records and construct a library, that sort of thing. Some place like the Citadel of the Censorate at Teremiton.
I thought we were going to take over Teremiton. That's the impression Hartarian gave me.
It might not be up to him. If the rest of the Censorate prevails, they might burn the place down rather than allow it to fall into our unclean hands. But even if we don't take it, there's a lot of stuff that we might be able to get from there, and we'll have to store it someplace. And the Order of the Secret Tower has a lot of books and scrolls that I want to move to Castal, or even Alshar, far out of the Censorate's reach. Half of them I don't even know what they do, but no one has been able to study them properly. And a lot of them might prove useful against the Gavani.
I'd offer Sevendor, but at the moment the place is stuffed to the rafters and stinks to high heaven.
I wouldn't want to put it there anyway, she agreed. You don't need to be in charge of our headquarters. I'll find someone for that duty. You're in charge of enough already.
You're telling me? All right, put it on the agenda. We talked like that far into the snowy night. At one point I even pulled on my fur mantle over my wool cloak and went to the top of the tower to smoke a pipe and watch the ferocious snow blow through the darkness. And after we finished talking, I stumbled back to bed, thankful that Penny had had the foresight to create the mind-to-mind spell.
One of the things that I'd missed most about being up in Beauval, or going from one little ward to another, was the lack of magi to talk shop with. Now I could summon some of the finest minds in magic with a thought, and consult with them, trade information with them, or query them. It was a wonderful improvement over hired messengers or pigeons, I reflected, as I fell asleep, but it also meant a lot more headaches. It meant that I could, and would, have a hand in politics, even when I was in my remote vale, far from the corridors of power. I disliked politics, particularly when they could end up with me dead. I don't know how long I slept, but at some point I came awake because someone was punching me in the shoulder. I was naked under the blankets and furs, and as I came awake, I realized two things. One, that my knee up to my waist was damp. No, wet. And secondly, my wife was pounding frantically on me, and some part of my brain knew that this was important.
"Men, get up,"
she said, her voice thick with excitement and dread. "The cauldron spilled." "Huh?" I asked, pushing the edge of the fur back sleepily. I couldn't recall that we had left one on the fire.
"The cauldron spilled. At least I think it did. I woke up and ow,"
she said, rubbing her belly.
"What cauldron? We don't have a cauldron in here," I realized, sitting up and gazing at the fireplace in the darkness.
I summoned mage sight and inspected the room.
"I don't see a—" "Oh, you idiot," she said desperately. "That's right, you wouldn't know. The matrons told me to expect this. My water broke. The cauldron spilled."
"So, what does—"
I started asking, wondering if I could go back to sleep and clean it up in the morning. Then what she said started to filter its way through my brain, but apparently not quickly enough.
"It means the baby is on the way," she said excitedly.
That got my attention. Everything that happened after that is a kind of vague blur. Before I was fully awake, there were seven people in my chamber and more on the way. My status as both husband and lord of the realm was suddenly insufficient to command anyone's attention. I was in the way. I stood near the bathtub and watched in amazement as my bedroom was quickly transformed into a birthing room by Alia's attendants. The fire was stoked, water was placed on it to boil, in an actual cauldron. Packets of herbs and oils appeared, and one of the older native Seven-Dori crones hobbled in and presented Alia with a wrapped bundle of instruments, the nature of which I could guess, but did not really want to know. I felt ill and dizzy at the same time. Someone complained about the light, and I realized that there was something useful I could do. I cast a small but bright mage light to hover over the bed, bright enough to read by. "There," I contributed. I tried several times to get near to Alia, and twice I actually got to hold her hand during one of the racking contractions. It was terrifying. Her eyes went white with pain and fear, and the cramping was so harsh she couldn't breathe, let alone scream. I was about to panic. Surely this wasn't normal.
"She's coming along nice, she is,"
crooned a crone at the foot of the bed as she rubbed Alia's broad belly.
"It feels like the lad's in position, head down, face down, bowed in reverence of the goddess."
I wasn't so sure about the baby's motivations, but then I recalled that Brigga is not just the patroness of bakers, but the patroness of childbirth too. Don't ask me how an elemental fire goddess, specializing in baking, poetry, and smithcraft, also got that job. So I began praying feverishly to her out of instinct, as Alia did her best to crush my hand.
"Are you all right?"
I asked, gasping as the contraction ceased and she could breathe again.
"Yeah,"
she grunted.
"That hurt. A lot."
"It looked like it," I said. "Can I get you anything?"
"Not but ice or snow, now that the cauldron has spilled," insisted another old biddy. "That's the goddess' command."
"All right," I said, unaware of such a command. But then I only paid attention to the baking side of things, not the childbirth, when the priestess of Brigga came to Talry when I was a child.
"What about—"
I said, trailing off when I realized I didn't really have anything else to do but stand there and be terrified.
"You,"
Mother Varane said, pointing a bony finger at me.
"Out! 'Tisn't proper to have a man in the birthing chamber yet. These are sacred mysteries."
"All right," I said, as they began to boil strips for bandages. "Let me just look at him one more time," I said, Glancing at Alia for permission, I placed my hand on her belly and closed my eyes, sending my magical point of consciousness deep inside to view my son. I had gotten pretty familiar with him and his snug little castle over the last few months, and while he was agitated, he didn't seem distressed. "He's fine," I reassured Alia, hearts beating, fists clenched, "and he's ready to come out." "I love you," she said, her eyes getting wider as the next contraction hit.
"Be gone, my lord," croaked Mother Verain, as someone grabbed my elbow and led me away. "We must begin the birthing ritual."
Alia had found the breath to scream this time, and then I was on the other side of a door that had been designed and enchanted to withstand a battering ram. Thankfully, Sir Kay was there to take care of me. He escorted me down to the crowded great hall, where I made the announcement to the folk who had been awakened by the fuss. Then Sir Kay led me over to the main table and poured a glass from a flask. It burned like a fire elemental going down. I barely tasted it. The next 2 days, yes, 2 days, was brutal and exhausting. While Brigga did not see fit to bless Alia with a gentle birthing, it at least progressed without dire complications. The third time one of the old biddies descended the stairs to inform me of progress, she smiled wanly.
"He's a stubborn one. Nothing in his way, but he doesn't want to come out yet."
"He probably knows there's 5 feet of snow on the ground," offered one peasant nearby, chuckling. "If I'd my druthers between snow and staying in some—"
"May I remind you that Lady Alia is your liege, Gascon, and referring to her privates in front of her husband during this sacred time. Her husband, who has a reputation for slaughtering entire armies with magic, might not be considered the best way to advance yourself." Sir Kay said it calmly, but there was no mistaking the tone.
"Yes, my lord," he squeaked, and shut up.
"The truth is," Sir Kay murmured as he poured another glass and began packing his pipe, "there is nothing more you can do. It is up to the goddess now, and every living man's mother diced herself with death on the birthing couch. You can do nothing for all of your power. Nothing but wait." So I waited. Sir Kay was right. I didn't have anything else to do. I waited, and I got drunk. For 2 days. It was a hellish existence, worrying about the wife I loved and the son I'd yet to meet, knowing both were in danger and I could do nothing. Food was set before me, and I ate. Someone was always refilling my wine glass. I prayed. I slept. I walked the hall. I talked to people. I put on furs and walked the battlements and watched the blizzard rage. But nothing seemed to penetrate past the idea that my wife was in mortal danger. A couple of times people tried to communicate with me psychically. After I explained what was happening, they left me alone. Penny was ecstatic and excited, so much so that I had to stop talking to her. I didn't want to be cheered up. I wanted this to be over. For 2 long days, Alia struggled, and for 2 days I led a numbed existence. But around midnight on the 3rd day, I was napping near the great fire, which was almost unnecessary, considering how many bodies we had packed in the hall, when something odd happened. I couldn't put my finger on it at first. Imagine hearing a sound a long way off, like a horse approaching. Only it wasn't hoofbeats, and it wasn't sound. It was magic. Not a kind I was familiar with personally, but it screamed at me the way a witch stone would. In my dream it got closer and closer, growing larger and larger, until it overtook me in a great wave of nasty darkness. That woke me up. I shook my head enough to be able to cast Mage Sight, which revealed a powerful magical force in the vicinity of my bedchamber, and since I was the only mage in residence at the moment, that was a problem. A very powerful problem, apparently. "Oh, shit," I whispered, as I felt the power grow and grow and grow. Uncontained and undirected. It was akin to the kind of raw, naked energy that a young mage feels the first time their talent quickens, an energy without form or fashion. Those, I knew, were very, very dangerous. I considered casting some kind of shielding spell, but I was unsure where to cast it, or if it would even have an effect on the sudden unknown spell being cast in my bedchamber. It was huge. A primal blot of bright green power that flooded in my bedroom to the point where it leaked out all over the castle. Something strange was happening. That spell had nothing to do with me. I met Alia's sister on the way to the tower, because she was coming to get me and she looked worried.
"He's just not coming out,"
Ella said, biting her lip nervously, her hand on her own very pregnant tummy.
"It's like he doesn't want to be born. I don't know what else to do. The old wives are saying to cut him out of her belly, but that's my fucking sister. Do something, Min,"
she exclaimed. "I'll take care of it and her," I assured her, giving her a kiss on the forehead and bounding up the stone stairs two at a time. The scene in the birthing chamber was a lot more chaotic than when I'd left it. Alia, thankfully, was either passed out or asleep, her face and bedclothes soaked in sweat. Her belly heaved up and down with every laboured breath she took, and one of the women, old Peg, stood by with a knife.
"She's having a hard time breathing,"
Mother Varain said, placing a wet cloth on her head.
"I think it will come to her or the child."
"That is not an acceptable finish to this story," I said flatly, pushing the woman out of the way. "I'm not a birth sister, but I can help. Clear the chamber. If you don't need to be here, be elsewhere," I commanded. All but two of the women retreated. I looked down at my new bride, struggling to bring our child into the world, and suddenly I felt horribly guilty for selfishly putting her in this position.
Men?
"Right here, Alia," I soothed. "I'm going to try some magic to make you more comfortable." She passed out before I finished my sentence. She was so badly off. I could watch how fast her pulse was racing by the tick on her neck. I began by summoning a breeze to press against her face, encouraging her to breathe. Then I abandoned simple mage sight and began a more intense probing of her big belly with a suite of more advanced scrying spells. I could see the problem at once. My little boy really didn't want to come out. That was apparent. Alia, for her part, seemed to have wrapped tendrils of magical force around the infant, keeping it in place. Alia wasn't talented, to my knowledge, in the slightest. I don't know how, but somehow my little boy had entangled his shroud's natural energy with Alia's, and he was resisting every effort of her womb to expel him. That was nearly impossible. Nearly. Most folks with talent don't know until they go through puberty, not in infancy. So how were both of them manifesting talent like that, much less using it? The spells had eased her breathing a bit, but she was still in a lot of pain. I glanced at the big curved knife the old lady had in her hand. That was not how I was going to lose my wife. I pulled my sphere from its protective bag and placed it over the covers, between her legs. Then I positioned my hands around it and began probing to see what precisely was wrong. With the sphere's help, I could tell pretty much anything about her body that I knew how to look for. In this case, the knot of energy between her and the baby was just too powerful. With the energy I summoned, I began the biggest counterspell I knew, and then I realized it wasn't what was required. I switched to a more thaumaturgical perspective then, and approached the situation as a problem, not a spell. The problem was, as I learned by scrying the sight, the baby had the umbilical cord wrapped around one shoulder, and refused to let go no matter what. He had manifested his power, raw power, unchained and untrained on his limited world. It was wild magic, and he was acting out of nothing but fear. For her part, Alia was desperately trying to deliver the baby, but every push did not bring him successfully into the world. It just pissed him off. I sank my perspective down and tried to commune with the kid, soothe him somehow. I tried to reason with him by mind, but there were no words there yet. I tried to project the empathetic idea that all birth is painful, but that it got a lot better afterward. Again, nothing. As my thaumaturgy revealed that there weren't any outside forces involved, I began to get the idea. If my child and my wife were bound, then the simplest and least destructive method of freeing them was an unbinding spell. At least that was my theory. And it failed. Alia's breathing became more ragged, and the baby was clearly unhappy, signifying the emotion by tap dancing on my wife's bladder from the inside. I tried again. A more powerful unbinding this time. To my surprise, the baby pushed back from my spell, and pushed back hard. My head hurt instantly, and I had to contend with a wave of raw magical power washing over me. I wasn't so easily defeated, however. If a regular unbinding would not do, then I changed tactics. I tried other thaumaturgical means to undo what they had accidentally done. It was a quandary, and I was running out of time. I began to chant and draw in the air the Morath sigil. It's an obscure piece of thaumaturgy, one of those spells you use if you are deconstructing a magically augmented artifact. It is supposed to be the most subtle way of parting two pieces. Usually they meant, say, a stuck fence gate, or a magic relic that needs investigation. Most magi don't bother to learn it, except as a component to other spells. But the Morath sigil has some unique properties. For one, it's scalable. That is, the more power you put in, the more you get out. Very straightforward. You can untie a knot in a string or an anchor chain with equal facility. You can lift protective runes off a 300-year-old artifact, if you know what you're doing. It's a broadly based spell that varies in intensity dependent upon the user. I had no clear idea what I was dealing with here. Wild magic? Baby magic? Really, goddess? Mage Lord, the time grows near, the old peg reminded me, the knife in her hand. You must make a decision, the baby or your lady. She cannot bear too much more of this. It is cruel to make her suffer so. Which one? Neither, I demanded savagely. I was not about to give up. I shall have them both. Clear the room, I ordered, and most of the volunteer nurses slipped away in fear of my voice. The brave stood near the fireplace, out of my way. I built up the most powerful Morath sigil I knew. For the first time I used the full power of my augmented sphere of Irionite, my witch sphere, and tapped into the flow of power I'd created at the axis of the building for good measure. I poured every last drop into the Morath sigil. I can't begin to describe the feeling of power I felt flowing through me. It was beyond anything I'd tasted before, like downing a glass of water and finding out it was actually a glass of 90-proof spirits. I didn't think my body could sustain such a flow for any length of time by itself. But it was working. Sort of. The baby was still resisting, but Alia had relaxed. I felt the baby move almost 3/4 of an inch on the next contraction. Alia was still out cold. I shaped the massive power as best I could, jamming it all into the Morath sigil. But that's as far as he got. The problem was, my son was resisting my efforts. Every spell I used to try to influence him was rebuffed, sometimes with great force. Only the Morath sigil had held. I remembered the tree folk sending their blessing through me to her, and I tried to keep that in mind, moving the magically tangible symbol over the Morath. That didn't help much, but it kept them both calm, I noted. Finally, when I felt the baby starting to slip from the grasp of my consciousness, I panicked. I had been gentle up to now. But now I didn't have a choice. I had to use everything I knew, and I was running out of options. I remembered a prayer I recalled learning in childhood, a simple rhyming phrase praising the Bright One, the fire goddess Brigga. It wasn't a spell, just a prayer to the goddess that baker's kids and other devotees learn. I held that prayer in my mind as a symbol, remembering mine and Penny's endless discussions on the efficacy of theurgy, and pushed the rest of my power through it. It was a lot of energy, but I was desperate. My wife and son were both in trouble. I figured if I could just let the baby slide out a little more, perhaps I could find a better way to approach the problem. Before I could decide what to do, the matter was taken out of my hands. The big ball of energy burst, quite unexpectedly. That caused several unusual things to happen at once. The baby slipped his head out past the umbilical around his shoulder, and his panic abated as he no longer appeared to be fighting for his life. Likewise, when the energy from the sigil affected Alia, her own shroud faded in strength, giving Junior a little extra wiggle room. I think I fainted. I know I lost control. But the spell had more power than I realized. In an instant, everyone in Sevendor was confronted with a bright wave of raw magical power emanating from my bedroom and sweeping out in a bright green wave in all directions. I heard dozens of shrieks and screams, and everyone's eyesight was blinded for a moment by a light that seemed to come from everywhere and nowhere at the same time. I regained consciousness because I was suddenly throwing up. I wasn't the only one, I learned later. Both of my apprentices had vomited, as had Kay, and a dozen or so others. Alia did too, but I was told that was normal in delivery. At the time, I just felt wretched and heaved far too much wine into the rushes on the floor. while everyone else was looking around in wonder. Every bit of rock, in every direction, was now a brilliant, shiny white.
"Oh, my,"
I moaned, my head and stomach reeling.
This is, oh,
I said, as I felt another wave. Someone eventually helped me to my feet and gave me a glass of water to rinse my mouth. I sat there, stupefied, as I marveled at the incredible transformation. It wasn't just the castle rock. It was all rock, in every direction, we figured out later. The castle stones, the natural stones, every rock and pebble, every speck of dust and clod of soil were turned white that day. The cliff face to the south of the castle was affected as well. In fact, the effect didn't diminish in the castle, we discovered later, but covered everything for nearly 2 miles in every direction. At the periphery, it faded out over the course of 100 yards, until the stone was once again normal. Sevendor Village, westward, Genley, even as far as Southridge, every scrap of rock was transformed into... what? When I had recovered sufficiently, I looked around in wonder myself. We did a lot of testing to determine what happened afterwards. The basic chemical composition of the stone hadn't changed exactly, but it had been augmented magically, somehow, creating stone with some unique properties. But at the time it was just white, 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 as if the entire castle had been made out of huge blocks of ice and snow. It was a mystery, and honestly, not the most pressing one.
"He's past the worst of it,"
old Peg said, putting the knife away.
"I think we can take it from here now that you..."
she said, trailing off. She didn't have any more of an idea of what I did than I did. I gave the baby and Alia one last check, and noticed that it was suddenly ridiculously simple to do magic here now. I stumbled downstairs and into the hall, where someone put a blanket over my shoulders and let me nap a few moments. I studiously ignored the stares and the cries of wonder and astonishment because my head was throbbing. Later, one of the crones descended the suddenly brilliant stairs and summoned me. She said not a word. I was told later that it was tradition that no one must inform the father of the fate of the wife and child until he's seen them with his own eyes. I don't know why. Just one of those traditions. But what I saw put the wonder of the castle's transformation to shame. My son was in the cradle near the fire, a nursemaid hovering over him, perfectly formed, recently bathed and completely the wrong shape and colour.
"My boy is purple?
Trigall, mother, and Brigga the Bright One, what have I done?"
I lamented. The crone cackled.
"All babies are thus, mage lord. Worry not. He's a fine, healthy lad, blessed with a magnificent head and a fine set of lungs. See for yourself."
She moved out of the way, and I summoned a mage light without thinking. Hardly necessary, considering how reflective everything was now. He was, indeed, magnificent. I'd never been able to distinguish between various familial characteristics in babies before. One baby looked like every other baby. But this one, suddenly I saw what other people did. My father's thick jaw, his mother's honey-coloured hair and brow line, his grandmother's ears, Alia's lips, and when he opened his eyes, I saw that they were mine.
"What a wonder you are,"
I breathed. He looked at me curiously, and then began to cry. "What did I do?" I asked, confused.
"He's just been born. Don't pay him any mind," soothed the old woman. "Go tend to your lady wife. She struggled valiantly and deserves your praise more than this little fellow deserves your wonder."
I approached my bed cautiously, and seeing me near, one of the other attendant crones pushed back the canopy to reveal my wife, my very, very tired-looking wife.
"Isn't he beautiful?" she said dreamily. "Oh, men. He's perfect."
"He is," I agreed.
"Thank you, Alia." "For what?"
she asked, confused. "For going through that," I said, taking her hand. "I've been in a lot of fights, but for 2 days straight, I couldn't do it." "You're the toughest man I know," I said, shaking my head.
"No man could have done it,"
she dismissed.
"Men, it was... oh, I wished you were here so badly. But they said it wouldn't be a good idea. I think they're right, in hindsight. Some things a man should never have to endure."
I said delicately, glancing up at the shimmering walls. "I see you redecorated."
"Me?
I thought you did that, she exclaimed. There I was, making the last push, and then wham! Suddenly I passed out. I don't even remember the first few minutes. They say that's a good thing, but when I woke up, this. I thought it was some spell you'd planted to celebrate.
I'm not that cunning, I admitted. Of course, the only conclusion that leads me to is, a son did it.
Our son? She asked,
her hand tightening on mine as her eyes got wide.
How did he?
I have no idea whatsoever, I assured her. It's a complete mystery to me. But he's fine, you're fine, and all I want to do is celebrate and hold my boy.
Of course,
she smiled, her face looking a little hard after 2 days of labour.
What are we going to name him?
That's right, I said. It hadn't occurred to me. He'd been the baby for so long. I hadn't even thought about it. We discussed a few possibilities and found one we liked the sound of, one using elements of both of our names, in Alshari Mountain tradition.
So, go tell everyone,
and then you can come back and make bug eyes at him while I sleep, as soon as you bring me some food.
What?
I asked. Who could eat at a time like this?
Food,
she repeated, gripping my hand tightly enough to hurt. I haven't eaten in 2 days, and I've been fighting with that little bastard the entire time. He was relentless, Min. I need food, and then I need sleep. So be a dear and have some sent up. Tell everyone the news, and then come back here with as much food as you can carry. And cider. I want cider.
Anything you want,
I agreed. I gave her a long, tender kiss, gave another to my son, and wrapped in a soft, glowy cloud of contentment and peace, I stood at the top of the stairs, where I realized a couple hundred faces were staring back at me expectantly and silently.
I have a son,
I began shakily. It somehow didn't seem real until I announced it. Lord Minalion the Snowborn, son of Minalan the Spellmonger, and Lady Alia is hale and resting comfortably. Now, can someone bring my wife some biscuits and cider before she eats the poor lad out of desperation? The entire hall erupted in cheers, and I fainted again.